Good evening. It's a privilege to be here again. I've been here a couple of times. It's been a most gratifying audience to speak with. I want to thank Bill and Martin for being such wonderful hosts and thinking of me and having me. It's very flattering to be invited back. They're really great guys, and I very much appreciate the courtesy and the kindness and the friendship that we have. So thank you. I want to say a couple things as preliminary to my talk. First of all is I am painfully aware, and I think most near-death experiences, and there's several here that I know of, who would agree with the statement that we're trying to talk about things that you can't really talk about. The word ineffable. I am aware that I am up here talking about ineffable things. I'm painfully aware that that's kind of bizarre to do that. But I believe that we have a need given to us by our Creator to want to know who we are, who our Creator is, and what our relationship is between us and our Creator, which is the source of the near-death experience. Because of our desire, and I think that this desire goes back even before history and is ultimately reflected in the sacred literature, and most especially in the Hebrew and Christian testaments. In the sacred literature that has been accumulated over time, expresses our desire to understand that relationship. I am an ordained pastor in the United Church of Christ. I do not believe in religion. I believe in God. I believe in Jesus Christ, and I believe in the Holy Spirit. But my faith is not in religion. But I love the church, and I have given my life over the past 27 years to the church. Heart, mind, soul, body, and checkbook. For better or for worse, the church has got it all. Because when you come up with a better plan for educating and loving and creating community around the concept of a holy and good God, I'm sticking with the church. When you come up with something better than that, tell me about it, and I'll be the first one in line to join your plan. Please, don't tell me what's wrong with the church. I just retired from pastoring for 22 years full-time. I know more than you do about what's wrong with the church. And anybody who's pastored a church would tell you the same thing. We're experts on how we could make the church better. So I want to go into a real quick description of my background so you'll see how well disposed I was to have this near-death experience and this new relationship with the Supreme Being. I was born in 1946 in Massachusetts. My dad was a veteran of the United States Navy. He went in, was a Lieutenant JG, served in the Pacific, came back from the war a different person. My mother told me that he was completely unrecognizable, and I don't mean physically, I mean he was a very changed person from the person that she had married. I grew up in the 50s and 60s in Massachusetts. It wasn't true, but we thought everybody went to church on Sunday. And in Massachusetts, we had blue laws. It was very difficult to buy gasoline or to buy bread and milk. Other than bread and milk, you couldn't buy anything in Massachusetts on Sunday. So Sunday, you know, everything was shut down. It was a church day. And my sisters put on their white gloves, and I put on my, I'm like a little five-year-old boy, and had my little hat and my little bow tie. And we all did our Easter parade thing to church every Sunday. And I enjoyed Sunday school. I enjoyed the attention of the Sunday school teachers. But as I became a teenager, one of the things I came to realize, and I'm saying this because I think that many of you may relate to it, I came to the conclusion that what we learned in church and what was preached in church and the thoughts and sentiments of the songs and prayers that we said in church bore no relationship whatsoever to what happened in our family or to the world around me. And I came to the conclusion as a young man that the church was a game. It was a ritual that my parents absolutely did not believe in. I mean, nobody else ever talked about their faith or anything like that. When I said, I don't want to go to church anymore, everyone said, well, fine. That's okay. You don't want to go to church? Fine. So that was the end of my church experience. Instead of church, as a young man, I started becoming interested in philosophy. In my high school, there wasn't any philosophy classes, so I was self-directed in my philosophical pursuits. I began by just reading authors that names that I'd read were philosophers. So I started off with like Aristotle and Plato, and then eventually, over time, moved my way through people like Immanuel Kant and into Jean-Paul Sartre, Martin Heidegger, and stuff like that. I got very, very involved with existentialism. This was, I should have mentioned, my big hero for a while was Friedrich Nietzsche, who is, from my opinion today, Friedrich Nietzsche is an absolute monster, but at the time he was my big hero. I came to the conclusion as a very young man, and this was solidified when I went to college and took philosophy in college at the age of 17, that life had no meaning. The world was a totally random place. There was anything supernatural was a fairy tale believed like simple-minded people to provide answers that they were either intellectually incapable or too lazy to pursue the truthfulnesses. And the fact was is that life had no meaning other than survival of the fittest. My career, my welfare, and my independence was the be-all and end-all of my existence. So the shorthand version of what I came to the conclusion of was, as an atheist, and I was a very committed atheist, was that there was no God. But technically speaking, I did have a God myself. By any definition, I created my own morality, my own understanding of truth. I was the source of reality. From a phenomenological point of view, my experience of reality was the only reality. Your reality was secondary or inconsequential to my reality, and therefore I decided what I would do and what I would not do. In any given situation, I could change my mind, which I did, depending upon how much I'd had to drink. You know, so during the day, I was more moral than 2 o'clock Saturday morning after being out with my friends drinking all night. I considered myself not a good man, I considered myself a perfect man. There was nothing wrong with me. And if you had dared to suggest that there was something wrong with me, I would come at you with all of my verbal skill. I became a university professor. I was an artist at the age of 25. I was a tenured full professor at the age of 27. A few years later, I was named Kentucky Artist of the Year and blah, blah, blah. I thought I was also the head of the art department at Northern Kentucky University. I was a charging, hard-driving alpha dog. Actually, I thought of myself as a bear. I had a wife and 2 children. There was one glaring problem in my superb evaluation of myself and my life was that I had a lot of suicidal tendencies, especially when I drank a lot, when it was late at night and I was alone, because there was something very, very empty in my life, and I had no idea what it was. Being your own God is a lonely place to be. Very, very lonely. It's also kind of depressing because you have to have pretty low expectations in order to fulfill them when you're your own God. On June 1st, 1985, going into the experience, I had, at 11 o'clock in the morning in Paris, France, at the Hotel de Luma, Lima on the Rue Saint-Germain, which is like a block from Notre Dame Cathedral, I had a perforation of the duodenum, which means I had a hole in my small stomach. The doctors in the United States told me that it's comparable to having a burst appendix. This is not a bleeding ulcer, it's a hole. What I felt was, one moment I was talking to Monica Schoner, making plans for our group, for our art tour for the rest of the day. And the next moment, I was on the ground yelling, cussing, kicking, thrashing, screaming in terror. And I had no idea what had happened. A doctor was called. He came to the room. He knew exactly what was wrong. He examined me, said I had to get to a hospital and have surgery, like now. Called an ambulance service. They carried me 2 floors down to the street and into the ambulance, and we went 8 miles away in a little tiny French ambulance going, arr. When we got to the Hospital General d'Assistance Public de Paris, in other words, the city hospital, I went into emergency, examined by 2 doctors, x-rayed, and they said that I had to have surgery right now. I couldn't go to another hospital. This was critical. My life depended upon it. I found out from the doctors in the United States that my life expectancy from the onset of this was 5 hours. Now, just to refresh your memory, this started at almost precisely 11 o'clock in the morning. It's now around 11:30. So they sent me a couple blocks away to the surgical hospital, which is Cochin. Cochin in French means pig, not an auspicious name. So I went to Pig Hospital. And unfortunately for me, and I'm sure unbeknownst to the doctors in emergency, there was no surgeon available at Pig Hospital, Cochin, because it was Saturday. And the wonderful socialized medical situation in Paris, there was no incentive for a doctor to be there on Saturday. I was put in a room, and they said they would be trying to get a doctor. From the time that I entered that surgical hospital, no one ever took my temperature. No one took my blood pressure. I did not have a pillow. I did not have a top sheet. I was never seen by a doctor. I was given no medication whatsoever. So if any of you get the bright idea that this was a drug trip, you know, I'll see you outside in the parking lot and I'll give you a drug trip. People always want to tell me it was a drug trip. And I begged all afternoon and evening for some drugs because the pain that took me down to the ground screaming and thrashing got 5 times greater, 10 times greater, 100 times greater, because as the hydrochloric acid and enzymes in my stomachs migrated throughout my abdominal cavity, the pain, which was fire, that was the sensation, was fire, just became enormous. And as a consequence, of course, I got tremendous scarifications and adhesions, which required later more surgeries, blah, blah, blah. Anyways, at 8:30 that night, a nurse came into the room and she told us that they were very sorry they weren't able to find a doctor and they would try and get one the next day, which would be Sunday. Now, for many, many hours, I knew very, very clearly that I was dying. And I was 38 years old. I was strong. I thought I was the most wonderful creature on the planet and stuff like that. And I didn't want to die. I had a lot to live for. So I was struggling to live, which consisted of trying to inhale and trying to exhale. I had to focus 100% of my energy in doing that. My wife and I didn't talk because it took all of my energy to breathe, and if I talked, I would lose the breathing, and then I would be in big trouble. And part of the problems with breathing was that it was agitating the pain in my abdominal cavity. Nurse left the room, and I turned to my wife, and I said, come over here and give me a kiss because it's time for us to say goodbye. I'm gone. I'm done. And she came over and she wept over me and I told her I loved her and I told her to tell my parents I love them, tell my kids I love them, tell my sisters I love them, pet the dog. And she cried and cried and cried and she finally sat down and she looked so miserable. She told me many times it was the worst day of her life because it was nothing, just sitting there watching your husband go away and nobody particularly interested in that in the hospital. And I closed my eyes to allow myself to die. Now, I knew at that time with certain as I'm standing behind this purplish podium in Salt Lake City, I knew that when you die, you die. End of story. And that anyone that thought anything differently was basically, I had seen corpses and caskets. I had seen dead animals on the roads. There weren't any angels hanging around them. There weren't any spirits floating around. You know, they're dead. It's over. It's like, that's it. You are an electrochemical mass with these thoughts that make you think you are something, and then when that process stops, the chemistry and electricity stops, end of story. I knew that for a fact. I was certain, 100%, and all of my friends who were all PhD university faculties all felt the same way. When I died, I knew that it was just the great yawning oblivion laying ahead of me. I awoke from that. To my great surprise, I was standing next to the bed, and I felt wonderful. The pain was gone, and I became very quickly aware that my senses had somehow heightened in ways that I had never experienced before. My eyesight, my taste, my touch, my hearing, feeling, all was magnified greatly. I thought that that was amazing. But of course, the most important thing that I was experiencing was that I didn't have the pain that I had been totally consumed by earlier. I tried to communicate with my wife, got no response from her, which made me very angry because the only conclusion that I could come to was that she was mad at me and she was ignoring me. I did not realize that she was oblivious to the fact that I was yelling and screaming at her. I became very disturbed because the bed that I occupied had an occupant in it. And the occupant in the bed that I was in bore this uncanny resemblance to me. But I knew that the person in the bed was not me because I was not in the bed. And any sane person knows that you can't be two places at once. I actually had the thought bifurcation is a sign of schizophrenia, and I'm not schizophrenic. So the only conclusion I could come to, and I knew this was a little weird, but it was the only thing I could make sense of, those crazy Frenchmen had made a mannequin of me. While I was unconscious, they rushed in and made a mold of me and made a quick wax cast of me and put it in the bed. Except that the problem was is that it was very detailed. It was an excellent job, right down to the mustache and the beard stubble and everything. I tried to communicate with my roommate, Monsieur Florin, no response from him. And then I heard people outside the room calling me, and they were saying in perfect English, which I thought was bizarre, because obviously the people in the French hospital all spoke French or with heavy French accents. And these people outside the room were saying, Howard, come, let's go. We're waiting for you. So I went over to the doorway of the room, and back in the hallway, which was gray and hazy, was a group of people. And I said, are you from the doctor? I'm very sick. I need to have surgery. And they said, we know all about you. We've been waiting for you a long time. Hurry up. Let's go. Where are we going? Who's the doctor? And they said, don't ask any questions. We don't have time for that. We're in a hurry. Let's go. Hurry up. Let's go. We know all about you. With some reluctance, left the bright lit room and went into the hallway, which was dim and hazy, and followed these people on a very, very long journey. One of the things that I came to realize at some point in this experience that I had lost all sense of time. And I've always had, and I do have to this day, a fairly acute sense of time. You know, when people think of eternity, they think like this time just extended forever. That is not what eternity is. In eternity, time has no height, no depth, no limit. If we live in a 3- or 4-dimensional world, if you include time as of the 4th dimension, in eternal time, it's dimensions without limitation. Pretty hard to explain, but anyway, so I was very aware. So if I were to simulate the journey with these people, I would have to walk like from here to the airport or something, or further. And as we walked, they became cooler and nastier, and I began to get pretty concerned that this was not good. Whatever I was in, this wasn't good. And as it got darker and darker and darker, I became convinced we weren't going to surgery. Wherever we were going, this was bad. And the people were starting to make vulgar personal remarks about me. And others were saying, just to increase my fear, shh, he'll hear you, be quiet. And we were in abject darkness, and I said, I'm not going with you any further. And they said, you're almost there, and they started to push and pull at me. And I fought them off as best I could, but there was more than dozens of them, maybe hundreds or maybe more than that. I can't tell you because we were in total darkness, so how do I know how many there were? I can tell you by their teeth biting through my flesh. I can tell you by their claws ripping off my skin. I can tell you by them probing the orifices of my body that there were many of them all simultaneously doing what they would. And their intention was to inflict as much pain on me as possible, as subtly as possible, to make this game of torment last as long as possible. Over a very long period of time, there was not enough of me materially left for them to do much with anymore. I was physically destroyed, and as far as I was concerned, which was much worse, was that I was emotionally destroyed. And that's all I want to say about that. I was lying there, and I heard my voice, and without it coming out of my throat, I audibly could hear my voice say, pray to God. And I thought, I don't believe in God. Stupid idea. And the voice said, pray to God. And I thought, I couldn't even pray if I wanted to. I don't know how to pray. Because I had probably said my last prayer when I was 15 years old, and now I'm 38 years old. So the voice said, pray to God. And I thought, when I was a kid, we prayed. We said prayers. I know prayers. I could do a prayer. And I was trying to think of a prayer, and not really intending to, I began, as I was trying to think of a prayer, began to mutter some prayers. And what I was coming up with was, God bless America, land that I love. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, his truth goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. The quality of mercy is not strain. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. Anything that I had memorized, any bit and piece, to my surprise and amazement, the people around me hated these crude little remarks that alluded to or mentioned God. And they were saying to me quite clearly and in language so vulgar, you can't imagine how vulgar and obscene it was. There is no God, nobody can hear you, and we're going to make it much worse for you if you don't stop. But the effect that it had on them, they kept backing away from me, backing away from me, backing away from me. One of the reasons why I'm giving you some detail about this particular episode is because it's good stuff. I'm giving you a hot tip. If you're ever in danger, pray any way you can. You want to hear a really powerful prayer? Jesus, help me! Or if that's too complicated, just try Jesus or God. Those are awesome, powerful prayers. Anyways, I found myself alone in that place. And I was there for, once again, I'm going to use the word eternity, time without measure. And I thought about what had happened to me. What I came to the conclusion was that as a father, as a son, as a brother to my sisters, as a neighbor to my neighbors, as a teacher to my student, as a friend to my friends, I had not done well. Matter of fact, in many respects, all I could think about is all the ways that I had failed in all of those relationships. I did not know why I had been born. I knew why I died. I mean, I'd just been through it. I got that part. But I didn't know why I'd been born. I hadn't known why I'd gone through life as I had. But I knew my life was a crummy, miserable, meaningless experience. And I didn't know what the purpose of it was and what I should have gotten out of it. But I knew that I surely hated the whole thing, despised the whole thing. And I knew that I was in a world where people like me, these were not monsters, these weren't Stalins or Hitlers or Osama bin Ladens, these were people who had lived lives like me. This is where they go in their rejection of all that is good, that is all that is kind and all that is loving. This is where they go. And in this world, absent of any goodness, they have at each other because that's all they've got left. That's what they did in this world, but subtly with the restrictions and customs and traditions of society, regulating their behavior to some degree. But in that world, all the restrictions, all the restraints were off, and they just went at it and did what they want to do. They would have embarrassed a dog with their behavior, and that I was one of them, and they were one of me, and that's who I was, and that I'd gone down the sewer pipe of the universe into the cesspool, and that's where I was going to be submerged. I wasn't in it. They were going to take me down, 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 deeper. So this place has limitless experiences, all kinds, and they get more and more vile and bestial and crude and gross as you go deeper into it. This was the good part. This was the nice part. This was indoctrination. I don't want anybody to go there. In my hopelessness and consumed with self-pity and self-recriminations, a thought came into my mind accompanied with a very strong feeling. And the thought was myself as a child sitting in a Sunday school classroom singing, Jesus loves me, this I know, la, 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 la. And the feeling was that there was this really nice guy who was really strong and really good, and his name was Jesus, and he loved me. And that when I was a kid, I used to pray to him like all the time, and he was always accessible to me. I mean, I don't know, as a kid, I sort of like felt like he was close to me. I began to think, why would he care, even if he existed? If he does exist, why would he bother? since I've rejected him, surely he's rejected me. And then I thought, I don't need to do this anymore. I'm tired of this. And I yelled out in the darkness, Jesus, please save me, with absolutely no preconceived expectation of what was going to happen next. And with that, a tiny light appeared in the darkness, and it got very bright, very quick. I can't describe to you how bright that light is because it's not light. I worked as a welder for a while. I was an arc welder, and sometimes when I didn't bring my hood fast enough as I was making my arc, I would flash myself. At least you kind of dazed for a second if any of you have done any welding. I'm talking about being inches away from welding. This light was much brighter than that, much brighter than staring into the sun. There is no light I have ever experienced in this world bright like this light. And this light came over me. And in that light, I saw myself, and I was Gore. I was no longer recognizable physiologically as a human being. I was just Gore. And out of that light came hands, and those hands came underneath me and touched me. And when he touched me, I just beautifully, fairly quickly reassembled and became whole. That was minor compared to the fact that when he touched me, I experienced something that is the most important experience of my life, which I am utterly incapable of describing to you, which was his love. And I am here to tell you that if I were capable of describing that love to you tonight, tonight would be a life-changing experience for all of us, if I were capable of doing that. It's love that we have no experience of. You know, I have been loved. I had a mother who loved me and family and all that, but I'm talking about a love far beyond any of that kind of love. I also want to convey to you that I realized something, too, that he didn't just love me in some big sort of theological abstract sense, but that he loved me as a person. It was very, very intimate, and he liked me a lot. As his hands went underneath me, he was picking me up, and he brought me up and held me very tight up against him. And I put my arms around him, and I did the obvious thing, is I bawled like a baby all over him, and I slobbered on him, and I spit on him, and I gurgled on him, and I held on to him for all my might, and he just loved me. And we're going to do that again. The sooner the better, as far as I'm concerned. Amen? We are definitely going to do that again someday. I need some Jesus with some skin on it. That's what I need. And he knows how I feel, and I'm not ashamed of it. I realized we're out of here. We're just going up, and we're starting to pick up speed, and we're going faster and faster and faster. And I'm hanging on him for dear life, slobbering on him, and I'm trying to get my composure. And now I'm starting to get like a little bit self-conscious about like being such a baby. I'm looking out, and all of a sudden I see we're headed towards a world of light. And I have the hugest, uh-oh, this is really, really, really bad. Because it dawned on me, in that world of light was God, God's home, God's world. And the love radiating out from that world of light was palpable and literally permeating through my body. And I'm going, I said to myself, I am a filthy piece of and he's made a terrible mistake. I don't belong here. And with that, we came to a complete halt, and he spoke to me telepathically for the first time. And he said, we don't make mistakes. You do belong here. Well, that the fact that he had heard what I had thought startled me more than his answer, because I hadn't said that. I'd thought it, and he had heard it and responded to it. And I said to him, rather than responding to what he said, I said to him, do you know what I'm thinking? And he laughed. And he said, I know everything you've ever thought. And then I had a huge, oh no. What if I think of something that I don't want you to know that I'm thinking about? And immediately, a big, beautiful boob came into my mind. I've always been a boob guy. And he thought that was hysterically funny. And he was like really chuckling. He thought that was really. And I was so embarrassed because it's like, what a stupid thing to think about. Of all the things in the whole universe you could think about, why that? Mama. My mother was a nurse and she didn't breastfeed us, so I guess I was deprived. So there's Jesus having a good laugh, and I was like, it occurred to me, he thinks I'm funny. This is great. I've got his attention, and he thinks I'm funny. This is wonderful. So we began to converse, and then he said, I want you to meet some people that know you. And so he called out with musical tones, and this group of people came around us, and they were other beings of light of different kinds of colors and things, lots of colors that I'd never seen before. They said they wanted to show me my life, and they asked me if I wanted to see them in human form because they knew me, but I couldn't tell who they were. And I said, I hate people. I never want to see people again as long as I live. I have reason to say that. You know, think back to the experience, you know. My experience as a human being had not been, you know, a highlight of my existence. They said, that's okay. They proceeded to show me my life, beginning with my birth to Howard and Wilma Storm in Newton, Massachusetts, and happiness and giggles and laughter. And my sisters, my older sisters, were so happy to have a baby brother, literally wiping the drool from my lips. Just all joy. And then as life went on, I saw my life deteriorate as I became more self-absorbed, more manipulative, as our family relationships deteriorated into just open warfare 24/7. Went off to college and became completely self-absorbed in making it in my career. Jesus and the angels expressed their disappointment and their actual heart pain with watching these episodes in my life as I became more and more selfish, lacking in compassion for other people. And when we would get to points in my life where important stuff happened that they skipped, like me getting tenure, getting promotion, becoming a department head, winning awards, having my paintings bought, they would skip those things. I'd say, wait a minute, you just skipped the most important thing in my life. And they'd say, that wasn't important. Here's what's important. Watch this. And they would show me ignoring a student who had come to my office with some sad personal story about his life, seeking a mentor, seeking a friend to listen to him and give him some advice. And me sitting at my desk, pretending that I'm listening, and in fact thinking about, they don't pay me enough money at this stupid university to listen to this garbage all day long. Student leaving my office thinking that he had met with Mr. Wonderful, our teacher, counselor, and I, of course, had very little interest in what was going on in their lives. I just use that as one example. I begged Jesus when I was still in my 20s. I said, I've seen enough. I don't want to see anymore. I don't want to see this. And he said, no, you have to watch the whole thing. And he made me watch my life. And I didn't like it. There wasn't much to commend it as it went on. Although by society's standards, it was all good. And I was successful. We got to the end of it, and he said, do you have any questions? And I said, I've got a million questions. And he said, ask whatever you want. I asked personal questions, historical questions, lots of questions about Jesus. I asked him questions about the future, about the past. I asked him everything I could think of to ask him, and everything that I asked, he answered carefully, clearly, and including visiting situations, like I would ask him about the Holocaust. So we'd go to Treblinka, hang out in Treblinka for a while. Don't ever ask him about that. You don't want to go there. It was not good. He showed me different scenarios for the future, good ones and bad ones. I hope we have the good one. Sometimes I don't feel it. Anyhow, we got through the Q&A. That went on, if you ask me how long that went on for, I'd say about 3 years, because it was much longer than the time I spent in graduate school. When we got to the end of it, I said, I'm ready to go to heaven. And he said, you're not going to heaven. He said, you got to go back. You're not suitable for heaven. He said, you got to go back and try and live a life that would make you compatible with heaven. So Jesus and I had a huge argument. And I argued as forcefully as I possibly could with all of my powers of persuasion and reason, which I thought were quite exquisite. And he chopped my reasons down. His intelligence was much greater than mine, and he just blew me out of the water with everyone. We talked a lot about prayer. We talked a lot about his presence in my life. We talked a lot about my mission in this world. I'll give you an example. When I was asking him, well, if I go back, what would I do back there? And he said, love the people you're with. And I said, yeah, well, what do you want me to do? And he said, that's it. And I said, that's not a plan. And he said, that is the plan. And I said, well, it's not much of a plan. And he said, well, it's God's plan. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that one out. If anybody understands that better, I'd be happy to share that with me. I'm trying to learn how to love. It's really hard. I've been doing this now for almost 30 years, and sometimes I think I've got it, and then other times I go, man, I'm not very good at this at all. You know, every time you think you're good at loving, oops, I blew it. Anyhow, I finally accepted the fact that because he wanted me back to this world, I needed to come back to this world. So I said, okay, I'll come back. So when I said I'll come back, no transition, boom, I'm back in the body. Pain that I had been in before, it hadn't gone away. So when I went back, all I could do was gasp like a fish out of water. You know, let's just go. And the nurse came into the room and she said, what's going on? The doctor has arrived. You're going to have the surgery now. This was 9 o'clock at night. So at 9 o'clock that night, a doctor showed up at the hospital. Go figure. Must be a coincidence, huh, Bill? I wanted to tell my wife what had happened, but they threw her out of the room, and I said, everything's going to be wonderful from now on. She wasn't buying it. I had the surgery at 10 o'clock. The next day, when they allowed her to see me about 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, she came in the room, and I had been awake for several hours. I knew I was just going to have a little bit of time with her, and I needed to tell her. And I worked and worked and worked to try and figure it out so I could say it in a simple, succinct way. And she walked in the room, and I said, it's all love. And she said, I love you. And I said, yeah, that's great. I love you too, but it's all love. There's nothing but love. And she said, yeah, well, your family loves you. And I said, I know that, but that's not what I'm talking about. I said, there is nothing but love. It's just love, which I would stand on that today, absolute truth. She said, what are you talking about? And I said, okay, it's like an ocean, and you have to dive into it and just be surrounded in love, because that's all there really is just that. You have to go into it. And she said, you need to sleep. You're not making any sense. Now, I'm giving her really good stuff, like I'm giving it to you. No extra charge. This is good stuff I'm giving her. And she's like, yeah, right. She's an attorney, by the way. So anyways, she leaves. And so for many years afterwards, I tried to explain what I experienced to her, and I got the same reaction from her. After her not buying it and telling me she didn't want to have any part of it, I didn't want to hear about it, she finally took the kids and left, which broke my heart because I loved her and I wanted her to know the love that I knew. She just thought I was mad as a hatter, and I guess there's a fair number of people that think I'm a complete nutcase. But I found this thing called the church. Have any of you ever heard of it? The church? There was one down the street from my house, a mile away. And I went there. Not only did I see that the church was filled with the angels, but I saw a group of people who I thought, if I played this really good, they wouldn't know what a really bad sinner I was. And I could get away with kind of like blending in here if they didn't find out about me. The interesting thing was nobody did an interrogation or an interview with me. And they just kind of like, oh, nice to have you here. We hope you come back. Great to see you, blah, blah, blah. And welcomed me in. The pastor paid me a visit. I told him what had happened. He said, great. I think you should join the church. And as soon as I got involved with the church, they gave me important stuff to do. Like the first thing I did was I painted the nursery all by myself. And then after going through new church member classes, they gave me the worst assignment in the whole church. This is worse than cleaning the bathrooms. They gave me the teenage boys for Sunday school. Ooh, really bad. And you know what? Me and the boys, we had a ball. And we talked about sex and drugs and drinking and rock and roll. And pretty soon I had the Sunday school superintendent sitting in on our class every Sunday, because the word got out that we were talking about stuff. We were talking about stuff that the boys were into. I said, what do you want to talk about today? And they talk about, let's talk about girls. Okay, let's talk about girls. What do you like about them? So we had a lot of fun. And then pastor asked me to, like, after I'd been there like a while, he asked me to join a class to learn how to visit sick and shut-ins. And in time, he asked me to read the scriptures from the lectern. I really felt like the church was a place that was trying to present the truth of what life was really about. And as I went back to the university, I really felt that the university has lots of good qualities. I was at a state university. It does not allow or appreciate the truth. And so I was in a dilemma because here I was a tenured university professor, department head, on the one hand, making really good money. And on the other hand, I could quit that and go to seminary for 3 years and become a pastor and make really lousy money. What should I do? So I decided the pastor thing. So I left the university and went to seminary. I went to United Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio for 3 years and served the church for 22 years, which was really good. And then I retired a little while ago. I do a lot of mission work. I've been working in a village in Belize, Central America for the past 12 years. Just completed 26 mission trips there with groups, and we've done a lot of work in that village. It's Maya Indians, and they're wonderful people. My wife that left me, she didn't do mission trips or anything else. My new wife, we've just got back from China a little while ago. We spent a month in China, preaching all over China. It was wonderful. We've been to Peru and the Middle East and done all kinds of, God has blessed us with great experiences. It was because of a conversation that we had at supper today with Bert, and Bert reminded me of how utterly irrelevant I am to the society as a whole. I'm very aware of that. I'm very aware that I am a fool, F-O-O-L. One that I serve, Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior, was also considered a fool. I don't care about governments. I don't care about this world. I care about Jesus, and he will win. And this world belongs to him. That's what I'm interested in promoting, because I believe that that is the reality. I think this is probably a good time for me to stop and open up to Q&A. This is really hard to do for me, because you know I need like 30 hours to tell this story, because I just gave you a little brief outline.
I would love to hear about the scenario Jesus gave you that of our future, and what you think about the negative and the positive and where you think we're leaning.
For thousands of years, God has been reaching out to all people all over the world so that we could be sons and daughters of God and live the way God wanted us to live. Most of the time, people were not interested. There was a tribe that was especially interested more than other people. They were called the people of Israel. You know, Israel means one who prevails with God, which was the name that Jacob was given when he wrestled with the angel. Those people were given that assignment. They tried their human best, but did not succeed in converting the world to be a godly world. God decided to pull out all the stops and come in the person of Jesus. You're not listening? I'll show you. I'll do it. And I'm going to make it so easy that you can't miss it. So that came 2,000 years ago. That was supposed to be the big turning point in history. You tell me how well we're doing 2,000 years later. How different are we than Rome? A little bit different. At least we don't burn people for entertainment, only in our fantasies. But God is not happy. I'm telling you the future scenario. I'm answering your question. God is going to change this world, and it's going to be extremely painful, and there's only going to be a few survivors because God's going to remake the world. This is one scenario, and it's not far away. So you don't have to worry anymore about presidential elections. You don't have to worry about your 401ks or your IRAs or how the stock market's doing. All gone. Everything gone, including your life and all of your family and all your possessions. All gone. Violently and terribly, if we continue on our present course. There is an alternative future that he showed me. And that, you know, that the story of the 100th monkey, if you get enough monkeys, you get enough like idiots like me going around talking about love and peace and hope and joy and all that good, naive stuff that's not realistic, that maybe you could actually have a heart conversion of the world. And I know I'm not alone in this, and Jesus made it very clear to me that there's millions of people I'm not like I think I'm the Messiah, because I'm painfully aware I am not. We're all Messiahs. You're all Messiahs. If we got enough people into this, maybe we could do it, which is what God wants us to do. God wants a loving and peaceful transformation of this world. And if not, God's just going to make it happen, because God's patience with the stubborn, bestial nature is at its end.
I remember reading your book. This is kind of a fine point, but something that I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm remembering wrong, but I remember when Jesus brought you up and you met with those beings of color, that you realized you were naked.
Oh, yeah.
And you asked them...
Why are you writing that? Are you trying to embarrass me?
Well, I'm not trying to embarrass you.
I'm
wondering, and I remember that they said, well, don't you think we've seen you naked before? But I'm wondering if you've been able to process that, and if you can comment on why you think that they didn't let you be clothed then for that that time that you spent with them.
You forgot the part. I was standing there like this. I don't know why, but I had lost my clothing in that place of darkness, which was a hospital gown. I just came to them like I was born. I don't think that would be normal of most people when they die, that they've been shredded like I'd been shredded. So I don't think that's typical at all.
Hi, I'm wondering about the communication. When you're communicating in that place, you said it was telepathic, and so you didn't have to speak. And I'm just wondering more about that process, about if you could feel each other's feelings or...
Yes. Not intensely feel each other's feelings. And I could hear his thoughts and he could hear my thoughts. One of the things that we need to learn to do is to train our thoughts, because our thoughts are more powerful than we know. And when we go to heaven, our thoughts are all transparent, which is like... If you don't like what you're thinking, that could be kind of scary.
Okay. And did it give you any insight into your communication when you've been back? Has it helped you grow in your communication? Because sometimes we can feel limited, or at least I can, on this planet and trying to communicate.
What am I thinking about you right now? Do you know?
No.
I'm thinking about her. and I love her.
So your thoughts turn completely to love? Have you found that your thoughts, think a lot about love?
Yeah, but I'm working on it, because I'm also a man, so sometimes the thoughts are not things I'm proud of, but right now my thoughts I'm proud of. Okay? And you know what? Women know it. Guys, you know when you're sitting around like lusting after women? They know that, don't they? Yeah, I know they know, because they give you this look. Why are you thinking that way about me? I mean, it's funny. We talk about intuition. We all have that capacity. We just don't really practice it or utilize it. I know when stuff's going to happen before it happens. And I know many of you do too. We have abilities that we don't utilize. And one of them is telepathic communication. It's really possible. And when we have a better world, we're all going to get way better at it.
Howard, I was wondering if you got any information on what happens to our pets when they pass away.
That's a tough one, because I'm a dog lover. I've got two dogs and a cat, and I've had dogs all my life, and if they're all in heaven, I am going to this herd of animals. They're all going to want to be my favorite, because they all were my favorite when they were alive. I don't know. I'm going to give you a vague answer, because all I can tell you is this. I know that they're gifts from God and that they are love. Love never ends. So whether their persona moves on to heaven or not, I do not know, but I know that the love that they represented is in heaven, because love never ends. Love never dies.
Expand upon the dark side, because you're one of the few speakers that have really talked about the dark side or had that type of an experience, and I was wondering why, in your experience over the last 30-plus years, very few people have looked at the dark side or experienced the dark side, and your insights.
Good question. Dr. Barbara Roma, who's deceased, was a Florida doctor. She surveyed and found that probably more than 15% of near-death experiences are negative experiences, are dark experiences. I've met many people that have had dark experiences, and typically they don't want to talk about them. And sometimes I wonder why I'm talking about it, because it's not very flattering. You know, it speaks very well of me that I did this. people ridicule you for having a near-death experience. Any of you here who've had a near-death experience all know that it's so much fun. You have this experience of the holy, and what do you get from your family and friends? Ridicule. I've even gotten it from clergy. When you talk about negative experiences, you're really going to be ridiculed because most people don't want to hear. People are much more willing to hear about happy, good experiences of the light. But when you talk about dark, painful, negative experiences, they really want to shut you up because I think it's way too challenging for them.
Wondering if during the time that you spent with Jesus, if he gave you any information about the rapture.
No, and part of the reason was he only answered questions that I asked, and since I had no biblical background whatsoever, that word wasn't even in my vocabulary.
For the benefit of the listening audience, I've got several accounts of your experience in TypeScript and radio shows, so my questions are related to those accounts so that the people can enjoy your responses. One of the accounts, you talked about life on other worlds, and you said that sometimes they come here and be with us, and sometimes they go and be with the people on other worlds. And you said that this world's in quarantine until we progress past our wars and our hates and different things like that. Can you expound upon that?
I could, but you did a pretty good job summarizing. Yeah, I was talking about UFOs. That's how the conversation got going, and Jesus told me not to trust UFOs because there actually is no physical space travel. I'm telling you what he said. If you don't like it, talk to him. What there is dimensional travel. There's a lot of dimensional travel. There are many, many universes. The overwhelming majority of them are not even in the physical universe that we know of. And so he said that, of course, angels are dimensional travelers, because heaven is close, but it's not in this physical universe. It's in another dimension. And the demons are dimensional travelers, and there's beings that are dimensional travelers. There's all kinds of beings, good, bad, and different, jokesters, fun, not so fun. And so he said, we need to be really careful. So personally, I only deal with absolutely tested, good, angelic, Christ-oriented beings. The Bible says, test the spirit. I think one of the reasons why we are in this world is to learn spiritual discernment. Read on the book by St. Ignatius Loyola on spiritual direction. You learn all about spiritual discernment. And I think we're here to learn about discernment. And I think that when you get involved with channeling, listening to spirits and stuff like that, you're traveling in very, very dangerous territory.
One other account that you talk about, you said that there are worlds out there where spirits can go to learn things in the physical.
Yeah.
And that this world is kind of like a safe playpen for bigger realities out there.
This world is a very lowly developed spiritual world. And there are worlds that are much more highly developed where they don't do things like kill Christ. Can you believe it? There's worlds where they don't want to kill. You know, if Jesus came back in this world, they'd kill him in a minute. There are good worlds, there are loving worlds, there are kinder worlds. And that when we move on, if we want to experience some of those worlds, that is a possibility. That's an opportunity that may be afforded us. And we can also fulfill different roles, such as being angels. Because the ultimate goal is to become more and more like Christ and ultimately to go into the presence of the very God of very God.
We appreciate the courage it must take to share the things that are precious in your heart.
Thank you.
And we appreciate your wisdom and high level of spirituality. With that said, I have a question. When babies are aborted, do those children have any contact with their parents who aborted them when they cross the veil, or are they given to someone else, or are they allowed to be raised later on in the millennium, or
okay,
are they
completely... Let me tell you what, I can't answer that only indirectly. I asked him about what happens to babies that don't get a... The way I asked was, so what happens to babies that don't get a chance to live? So I was also thinking of miscarriages as well as aborted babies. And he said that they will get another chance at life in this world. But that's all He told me, so whether they come back to the same family or different family, I don't know the answer to that. I think abortion is terrible, but we don't destroy babies. We don't kill babies. Their life is from God, and so we thwart God's plan and thwart their opportunity to have a life, but they do get another chance. For people who said, you believe in reincarnation, I do not believe in reincarnation. I'm talking about babies, you know, that never had a life.
So you, when you were in your darkness, you prayed to Jesus and you asked him to save you. But there were other people around you, the people who were attacking you, or the beings, I guess, sorry. Do you believe that the reason that they stayed down there, or do you know if the reason that they were stuck there is because they didn't pray? They didn't take that opportunity?
Absolutely. Not only do they not pray, they hated anyone who did pray, and they hated God.
So you think they absolutely rejected Jesus, absolutely rejected God, and that's why they were there?
Yeah.
Kind of along those lines, I just wondered if when our loved ones die and maybe they weren't doing all the right choices, if we prayed for them and they were in that torment, if that would help them.
Our prayers would help them?
Yes, while they were struggling in that area.
Absolutely. Prayer is always good. I went to seminary. I've been in discussion groups with clergy. People talk the best kind of prayer and the right way to pray. And there's actually people that make money selling books on how to pray more effectively and praying with more power and blah, 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 blah. Pray from your heart. I'm telling you flat out, from God's mouth through my lips to your ears, pray from the heart. That's the way to pray. And if it's simple and crude and raw, I mean, even if it's ugly, doesn't matter. You just pray from the heart, whatever it's feeling. If you've got pain in your heart, give it to God. I have yelled and screamed at God in prayer, like when my sister was dying. You know, I don't want to tell you because it would horrify you if I told you, but I let him have it. Because God knows already. He already knows. What do you think you're hiding? You know, you think you could put some petticoats on it and put a little lipstick on it and make it like more acceptable to God? He knows what you're feeling. Let it out, to express it to God and give it to him. Remember, he's the one who said, you know, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. Give him the grief, give him the pain, give him the anger.
Sir, based upon your out-of-body experience, sir, is the second coming of Jesus Christ relatively nearby our reckoning of time, or only relatively nearby his reckoning of time? I know that time is different for Heavenly Father than it is for us. Reckoning of time.
First of all, I don't think it's far off. Martin and I were talking about this earlier, and Martin will know I'm a fool if I give a date. So I won't do it. I'm not going to give a date. I'd be happy with, like, in the next 4 minutes would be good. I would be very happy with that. And I would rather you all had a sense of urgency about transforming this world than to have a sense of complacency.
Something that I always was struck by, when you first entered a church after leaving France, why don't you share that? I mean, that was a very...
The first time I went to church, I was still recuperating from my illness. I left France very sick, went to a hospital in the United States, was on critical list at St. Luke's Hospital in Fort Thomas, Kentucky for 5 weeks, had to have more surgery and stuff like that. So by the time I got to church, I was very weak and had to do a lot of rehabilitation. So as soon as I was barely ambulatory, my then wife and I, we went to church, and you know, it was like getting up, taking a shower, getting dressed. I put on a suit and a tie and all that. It's a lot of exertion when you're really, really sick. My wife parked across the street. We walked across the street, went into the church. The ushers opened the door, and they were singing, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. And when I stepped in there and the congregation was singing, the whole ceiling was full of angels, and the angels were full of joy at the praise of God. So I did what I thought was appropriate in the presence of hundreds of beautiful, luminous angels. I tried to get under the carpeting. Now, this is a traditional, not Pentecostal church. It's a very mainline, ordinary, middle-class church. The ushers came running, trying to get me up off the floor, and I'm literally trying to somehow get under that car. I wanted to hide under the carpet. I was praising God loudly. And My wife was bent over me going in a whisper, "You're making a fool of yourself. We'll never go to church again. Why do you have to make a spectacle of yourself? Get up, you idiot. You're acting like a fool. What is the matter with you?" The ushers figure that I'm having a stroke or a heart attack or something like that. So they're trying to bodily lift me up. And I'm like fighting them because I want to be prone on the ground, praising the angels. So finally they get me in the seat. And so I sat through church watching the angels, weeping and praising God. Praising when the preacher was preaching, praising when there was silent prayer, praising him when, I just praised and praised. Do you understand? Not Pentecostal church. If I'd been in a Pentecostal church, I would have been a star. They would have ordained me. But I was in the wrong place. I made a real spectacle of myself, and I was so happy when I went back. Nobody reminded me of that.
I'm wondering if you could determine whether or not the beings that you saw, all of them, any of them, had lived mortal lives. Or
in the darkness?
Those two, yeah, those in particular, but also any...
All of the beings, including Jesus, had lived mortal. Everybody I met had lived mortal lives. Everybody.
Okay.
Both in the dark and the light.
I realize that when you make such a flying, rolling reversal from worldliness to godliness, that you face rejection. I'm just curious if, by virtue of the life and trajectory that you have striven to live, if your daughter's seen the light.
No.
You mentioned that you could see spirits when you went into the church. Can you still see spirits now?
When I want to. I mean this sincerely. That can become like addictive, like wanting to have supernatural experiences all the time. And for a long time, I did. I wanted supernatural powers. I wanted supernatural experiences. I lived for it. And it became like a huge vanity because, like, I knew more than other people, you know. And I would tell people stuff that they didn't want to know. And eventually I decided that that was not good. And so now I try and see the Christ in everybody that I meet, including you. That's what I want to see. I want to see you with the eyes of Jesus, the eyes of God, which is... I mean, when I said you all are the Christ, that wasn't some glib remark. That's how I want to see you. You know, and hopefully, conversely, you know, that you would see me that way.
I just have a quick question. When your wife was there in the hospital with you, did they record the time that you were gone, or did she know that you had died at that point? Or was there any discussion of that?
There was nobody in the room except for her and Monsieur Florin. I was getting no attention at all.
Okay, was she aware that you had passed away? Or left your body?
We've talked about it, and she's kind of vague about it.
I've experienced that overwhelming sense of love that you've described and can't wait to feel that again. I'm not quite sure I understand what you mentioned when you said in your scenario that God would need to destroy or to bad things could happen. We could experience agony. Things continued on the way they are.
Okay, let me amplify that a little bit. Jesus told me that. Everything that we have is a gift from God. I mean, the whole creation is a gift from God. Our lives are created. But more specifically, the United States of America, the greatest country, the richest country, the most powerful country, the freest country. This is the place. Everybody in the history of the world, if they knew about this, would want to be here. Everybody in the rest of the world wants to be here. I do mission work. And believe me, I could fill up boatloads of people and bring them here and just say, yeah, it's okay. When I was in China, all the people, how can we get to the United States? Can you give us a job? Can we come to the United States? Please, can I go to the United States? I mean, people begging us all over China, can we come to the United States? This is where you want to be. The reason why it's good is God, God, and God. We didn't do anything to deserve it. We aren't the best people that have ever been, and we aren't the best people. God gave this country a blessing. To be a blessing to those who are given much, much is expected. We have not fulfilled God's expectation of being a blessing. We're not the holy nation that God wanted us to be. And so what God will do is he'll withdraw the blessing. And when he withdraws the blessing, there is going to be mayhem and chaos that will ensue.
Even with people that are feeling that sense of overwhelming love and warmth that you've mentioned.
Yeah, we'll be the first ones killed off. We'll be the first victims. We're dead meat. We get to be like Nero's victims in the Colosseum. How fun is that? No, I'm sorry. I mean, really.
You said your daughters didn't see the light. Can you describe what your relationship is with your children? And if has this divided you? And if so, how do you reconcile that with your experience?
I have two families, a son and a daughter with my first wife. My ex-wife and my two children have nothing to do with me, nothing. And it is exceedingly painful for me. I don't know how it is for them because they don't talk to me and haven't in many years. And I have a new wife with four children. We have warm, loving, great relationship with all four of her. They're my stepchildren, but all four. They're all adults. Because of, I needed to go to Al-Anon for a long time. Al-Anon is for friends and families of alcoholics. You do a little figuring what that might mean. One of the things that we learned is that there's things that you can't do anything about. And so you need to do a little bit of disassociation, emotional. I'm working on it. It's exceedingly painful. I couldn't give anybody any advice. Everything I've tried has been rebuffed.
Hey, another question. I heard you say in another conversation that God hates suicide. I also told you about my medical situation. When my last days come, just to avoid suffering, I am planning for myself. Would that be acceptable, or is that not good?
Yes, you're okay. I'm glad you said what you said at first. It's not suicide. You all know that a little judicious use of morphine, elder care, is common practice in our country. If any of you think that's murder, I think you're nuts. As a pastor, I've been in those situations. I've been in situations where you have to turn off the equipment. It's not murder. It's not suicide. When there is, the prognosis is nothing but overwhelming suffering, and there's nothing they can do about it anymore.
I'm wondering, you've mentioned that you said you've seen angels. How much and how involved are they with helping us down here?
Well, that's a great question. I asked that question, and I asked the angels, and they want to do everything for us. They would like to wait on us hand and foot, because they are instruments of love and compassion. But they know that if they did that, they would be robbing us of what we're here to do, which is our life experience. So when they intervene, which is rarely, it's with the permission of God. I've met many people who have had incredible angelic interventions in their lives. But it's always been under very, very dire circumstances, very dramatic circumstances. So it's okay to ask them, but most of the time they're going to go, we'd like to, but we can't. It's better for you to just, you know, go through this. But they will intervene, and they're always with us.
This has been so exciting to be in your presence. And I did read your book, and it was really, really interesting. I was just wondering, I just want to make a statement. God and those with alternative lifestyles that are good people?
Sure.
Just respond.
Hey, we're all sinners. We all fall far short of the glory of God. We have no business judging anyone. Now, we do have a business on modifying. If someone is hurting somebody else, that definitely is our business, to keep people from hurting each other. But sin is sin. We're all sinners. The Bible talks about lying 360 times. Anybody in here ever lied? You're a sinner. If you read all the sins in the Bible, we're all sinners. We're all big-time sinners. I sin every day. Not because I really want to. It's just I'm a screw-up. I try not to, but I mess up. And I'll tell you one of the ways that I mess up. I want to be the Christ to my wife and to my family. I want to be the Christ to everybody, but I'd really like to be the Christ to my wife. Her name's Marcia, and she is a wonderful woman and a real godsend to me. There's days when I'm not sympathetic to her. There's days when I'm not patient with her. There's days when I'm much more interested in my stuff than her stuff. I put me ahead of her. Those are some of my sins. And I am working on it. Her phone number is 859. I hope that she would say, he's doing the best that he can. And you know what? Doing the best that we can is all God asks of us. God knows perfectly well what I am and what you are. And God just says, are you doing the best you can? I said, God, I am really doing the best that I can. I'm honest. God's honor. You know, honest to God, I am trying. And God says, I love it that you're trying to keep trying.
I'm Sandy Cherry. How are you? I just wanted to give everybody a little bit of hope in one area, and that is I'm on the board of directors of IONS, and we've done a lot of research and heard a lot of near-death experiences. And one of the most beautiful things is to hear of those who have gone on the other side and their pets have greeted them. So I want to cheer from everyone in the audience who has a pet, because over and over again in near-death experiences, we have heard that they have had their pets. Okay. Howard, I've read your books and heard you on many occasions. You talked about this sense that touched me tremendously when I read one of your books, which was this unbelievable awareness that you were so unworthy as you looked at this beautiful city of lights or the place where God was. And I just thought that was such a poignant part in your book that I would just love for you to share that with everyone. It was amazing.
Far, far from heaven. I don't know how to calculate, but Jesus and I moved really fast, but I would say it was like thousands or millions of miles away, far away. It was so bright, so huge, and the love that emanated from it was so permeating that I just knew that I was not at that time. I'll tie this all up with a nice little bow here. This is a classroom. Love is the lesson. Good night. That's it. That's it. And if you want to go to heaven, you have to know how to be a loving person, because that is the requirement. That's the SAT, the ACT, the whole requirement for getting into heaven is if you have love. And you know what? God knows if you're a loving person. And that's all God is really, really interested in, were you a loving person? Because if you're a loving person, that means that you're going to do your very best to live a life pleasing to God. Loving people don't abuse children. Loving people don't abuse their partners. Loving people don't cheat at work. Being a loving person implies a whole huge morality, but you do it out of love, not out of fear of getting caught or out of fear of being punished. And I didn't have that. Remember when I started this thing off, I said there was a great emptiness inside of me? Well, I know what was missing now, and it was the love of God that was missing inside of me. And now that I have that love of God, I've got the opposite problem. Now my cup overfloweth with goodness and mercy, and I'm trying to find appropriate ways to pass it out. So I have to go all over the world talking about Jesus and building houses and taking doctors on trips and preaching and stuff like that, opportunities to share that love. I try to live a relatively exemplary life. I want to live a life that's pleasing to God. And so I don't want to do stuff that I think is vulgar or cheap or shoddy or dishonest.
Yeah. We'd like to thank Howard Storm for being here tonight.